Our next guest on Downtown, a journalist and author of books, including A Futile and Stupid Gesture, as well as Orson Welles' last movie, The Making of the Other Side of the Wind. Always a treat when we catch up with our friend Josh Karp. We talked to Josh yesterday and began our conversation getting his thoughts on the passing of legendary actor Norman Lloyd at age 106.
I'm not an expert on his life, but what an amazing life. I mean, here's a guy who, he was blacklisted. He was involved with Orson Welles early on. He had this, career that had ups and downs and, all over the place. I mean, I remember him, probably like most people of my generation from St. Elsewhere.
Right, right.
But no, I would say he definitely falls into the category of a life well-lived, for sure.
No question about that. Well, in regard to Welles, and you've written about Orson Welles, was he, to the guys who were close to him, was he a loyal guy?
Yeah, he was really loyal, I think, as long, I'm trying to think how to qualify this. He was very loyal to people. I mean, there were people who, like Norman Foster and Agnes Moorhead and, all these people who would kind of crawl across broken glass for him and who he involved in project after project and, felt were completely brilliant actors and things like that. I mean, the problem with Welles, and I don't think I hate to use the word used, but he, I think, without malice, he used people. I think, he kind of, he had all that goodwill built up with these people. And so he knew that they were willing to kind of go with his craziness. I remember somebody telling me a story, I think it was when he was making Macbeth, about how they were shooting, in like Morocco or something like that. And all of a sudden they ran out of something and he had like about 15 people there. And he was like, everybody just hang tight. I'm going to Italy to make a movie for 3 weeks. and then I'll be back with enough money for, the film or whatever we need to finish the shoot. And people hung with him, so he was super, like John Moreau, he was, very loyal to, and she was very loyal to him. Though who wouldn't be loyal to John Moreau? And, and lots of people, I mean, there were people who were with him through everything who he stayed close to. And I think he always, there were a lot of people he had great affection for. The big issue was, that affection oftentimes meant that you were waiting in Morocco for 3 weeks, not knowing if he was ever coming back. And I'm sure there were incidents where he did not come back and you didn't know that until 5 weeks later.
There are so many great stories in the Odyssey that became The Other Side of the Wind, but one of my favorites is what happened with Rich Little. Can you explain that a little bit?
Yeah, sure. That was honestly like the, high point of, not the high point, but one of the unexpected high points of working on that book was, first of all, interviewing Rich Little, who basically, this incredible impressionist who, which is, something of a lost art form. You don't have, famous impressionists anymore. And here he was having conversations between Orson Welles and John Huston in their voices on the phone with me, like dead on, nailing both of them, which is great. But Rich Little was hired because Welles wanted a character who was like Peter Bogdanovich. And who was a young, successful movie director who had kind of surpassed his mentor, which was this, kind of weird Wellesian, thing, because that's what was kind of happening with Bogdanovich and him. And one of the things Bogdanovich loved to do when he got really famous was he loved to, go on the Tonight Show and all these other shows and do celebrity impressions. And he did Cary Grant and he did Jerry Lewis. And, and he was a real, it is about Peter Bogdanovich. He loved every aspect of Hollywood. And I think he just loved getting to do that. So Orson hired Rich Little to play the part because Rich Little was a great impressionist. So he figured he could do this character that one of his, character ticks was doing impressions of famous people. So he gets him to come to Arizona, and Rich Little had told him, you know, hey, I can, you know, who had never acted before, by the way. I mean, literally,
right,
right. Had never done anything but impressions. And Orson got him to come down to Arizona, and Rich Little said, you know, I've got like 6 weeks. He's like, but I'm booked, you know, in Vegas or Tahoe or someplace for a year solid after that. So you got to shoot me in 6 weeks. I can't miss a day. You know, I'm committed to this. And Wells said, he did what he did with everybody. He said, of course we'll be able to do that. You know, with not, you know, because he was always thinking, you know, a year ahead and 2 days ahead, but never anything in between. And so they started shooting Rich Little, and all kinds of, you know, delays went on. And then one day, now there are different versions of the story, but Rich Little's version is that finally the day came where he said to Orson, you know, hey, this is the day I've got to leave. And other, you know, other people said that Rich Little just vanished, that he got fed up and disappeared. Nobody knew what happened to him. And that Wells was kind of left in the situation of, oh my God, one of my main characters is gone. But according to Rich Little, he said, you know, hey, now I got to go. And Wells said, okay, don't worry about it. I'll shoot you on the way to the airport. And so he got him in the back of a limousine going to the Phoenix airport from Cave Creek, Arizona. And Orson is just in there with a handheld camera, you know, just asking him questions and shooting stuff with Rich Little, which is just, you know, perfect. Now, of course, as it turned into for Wells, Wells used this as an excuse to start the movie almost completely over. because I remember, I think Frank Marshall, who the producer, said something like that to me, said that Orson, as usual, used this as a reason to start over. And my favorite part of all of it is that he then hired Peter Bogdanovich to play Peter Bogdanovich without saying you're playing yourself.
Right.
So that always, I love that part. So.
And one of my favorite interviews we've ever done here was talking to Bogdanovich a couple of years ago. He was great, so generous with his time, but he wanted to always make a point that he had mended fences with Orson before the end.
Yeah. Yeah, he did. Orson had, you know, so many relationships that are hard to think of anyone else in Hollywood having had, you know, like going back to your question about the loyalty, you know, his cinematographer, you know, was with him for, you know, 15 years, you know, and having to make porno movies on the side to actually get paid for something, yes. But was totally there whenever Orson wanted him.
Yeah.
And with Peter, he was, you know, I mean, I think Orson, you know, that really kind of, to some extent, betrayed Peter a little bit. He kind of, you know, I think was, you know, didn't feel great about the fact that he had been surpassed. He liked to view Peter, and he loved him, too. I mean, I think Orson absolutely loved Peter. But I think there was this, you know, distance he would create by, you know, kind of basically, you know, crapping on somebody behind their back. And Bogdanovich, since he'd become so successful, was a good example of that. And, you know, there's the story. What happened was Orson wound up taking over Peter's house, which was this big mansion in Bel Air. And he was sitting there and living there. Peter, he said, can I stay here for a little while? Peter said, sure, I'm going to Europe to shoot a movie. And when he came back, his house was a film set. And I remember Sybil Shepherd telling me that she and Peter were living in this tiny little corner of this mansion, and everything else belonged to Orson. And it was like the man who came to dinner. Like he set himself on fire by putting a lit cigar in his bathrobe in the middle of the night and falling asleep. He, you know, would buy fudgesicles and eat like 1,000 fudgesicles and then start screaming about who ate all the fudgesicles. I mean, it's and I love the idea of him accusing Sybil Shepherd of eating on the fudgesicles too, because it was, you know, the three of them. But what wound up happening was Peter finally had to say, you know, Orson, you know, you're going to have to start planning to find a place to do this elsewhere. And Orson, you know, said, of course. And then Peter went to the studio that day and came back and everything was gone. Like this whole, you know, set, this whole world Orson had set up there was gone, and he couldn't find Orson for like a week. And at that was kind of Orson's breakup with him at the time. He, you know, he you know, was not great, obviously, at, you know, at feeling like he'd, you know, feeling in a secondary position, I guess, to somebody. So he, so he just vanished, and that was, there were great exchanges of letters between the two of them that I remember reading after that are, you know, just, you know, Peter kind of, you know, saying like, well, could you, you know, possibly pay me for, you know, the fact that I paid rental on another house for you? And Orson just saying, you know, like, well, you know, you have to take that up with my producer. You know, I'm not going to give you that money. So, but yeah, Peter, in the end, you know, when I spoke to him, had nothing but affection for Orson. And I think Orson truly loved him. I think he just had, you know, his way of showing that he loved somebody was not the way perhaps the rest of us.
We're talking with Josh Karp here on Downtown. Did you see Mank? And if you did, what were your thoughts on it?
Yeah, I did. You know, there's the whole, you know, and maybe not obviously because I, but for people who are like really big Wells people, this is like the huge Orson Welles, you know, like the way he really got screwed, I guess, for lack of a better word, because Pauline Kael wrote this big, you know, article in the New Yorker saying that, you know, Mankiewicz was the genius behind Citizen Kane and that Orson took all the credit. And it was a very flimsy, certainly journalistically, you know, piece of writing. So people were, you know, making Mankiewicz the hero of Citizen Kane and the genius of Citizen Kane and taking away the one thing that Orson kind of always had, you know, that was he was always that guy. And, you know, so there are a lot of people who just the second the idea of this movie happened were really worked up. So I didn't have that problem because I just tried to accept it as a movie. And I know that movies fudge the facts and you got to do that to make a movie. That said, I was really bored. I don't. What else to say? I mean, my criticism is not necessary. I mean, the way it treated Orson Welles was funny in that a couple times he shows up and he just, even what, no matter what he's saying, he just looks like he's the devil. Like, the guy who played him did a great job, yeah, but also made him very devilish. But I just didn't, you know, like, I don't know. I remember talking to somebody and they were like, you know, writers always love to write about people writing. And there's nothing more boring than watching someone write and on screen. And, to, you know, kind of, I mean, I know more than that happened in Mank, but I just found it, you know, I was like, okay, yeah, that's kind of that, you know, like the writer's story has to be a great story for people to want to watch that. And I say that as a writer. So I was bored. That's the bottom line. I, you know, I thought it was fine. I thought Arliss Howard was great in it. You know, I thought, Tom Pelfrey, who played, you know, Mankiewicz's brother, was great in it. Mm-hmm. Gary Oldman was, you know, terrific. You know, everybody was good. I just kind of didn't hold my interest. And I am like the market for that kind of movie.
Well, I'm with you on that too. And I had trouble with the, you know, the age, and like Oldman was great, but I'm like, he's way too old to play that part.
Right. Oh, for sure. Right. I mean, yeah, absolutely. I mean, yeah, you would not, I would be hard pressed to think of, you know, it altered things in a way, you know, because you're thinking of Mankiewicz as this cranky old man.
Right, right.
And he's what, in his, you know, supposed to be in his 40s?
Yeah, early 40s, I think.
Yeah, early 40s. And he looks, you know, he looks older than me, so that's not a good sign. No matter how much he was drinking.
Josh, we can't have you on without talking a little 1970s. So let me throw this this curveball at you out of nowhere. If somebody said to you, what movie, and not the best of the 70s by any stretch, but what movie could tell people from another place and time what the 70s were all about more than any other film?
Whew. That's a great question. I can think of a couple. I may have said this to you before, but the one that really sticks out to me is The Bad News Bears, primarily because it is, I think, the most accurate depiction of what it was to be a child in the 70s.
Oh, absolutely.
It takes place in California. I grew up outside of Chicago. You could have grown up, you know, in New Mexico or Nebraska or Montana, and you watch that and you're like, yep, that's what it was like, because it feels like it. You know, like I watch it and I go right back to being 10. And Michael Ritchie's movies, who directed that, who's kind of, you know, didn't really, you know, wind up being all that, all that famous of a director. I think, people don't look back and go like, oh my God, Michael Ritchie. But he also made this movie called Smile.
Oh yeah, with Bruce Dern, right?
Yeah, with Bruce Dern. And it was, there was this whole, the 70s were a fairly unsupervised time in which to be a child. And there was not the amount of content. And my recollection of my childhood is that Smile was on at 4 o'clock at least twice a week on TV. It was just always on. And it was so far too adult for any school kid to watch when they came home from school. But like all my friends and I saw Smile like 500 times. And, and it's about this Southern California beauty pageant and kind of suburban angst and misery of the adults of that time. And it was like watching that was like going to the Pinewood Derby for my Cub Scout troop like 85 times in a row. So those two movies to me really just feel like the 70s. You know, I mean, Bad News Bears particularly, I think that one, it just absolutely, just nails it. I mean, I watch it any time and I'm immediately 10 years old again, with the dad drinking in the stand.
Oh, and it's for my money, it's the best sports movie ever made.
Absolutely. And it's like, I mean, that and Rocky are the only two where they lose, right?
Yeah.
And it's a victory, which which may be a metaphor for the 70s on some level too. I think it's the best sports movie too. I think it's a great, I don't know. I mean, it's got what I love about it is how, you kind of like, when you think about it, you think like, oh, Walter Matthau, he's got this great relationship with Tatum O'Neill's character, and he's like a surrogate father figure, and you're like, you forget the part where he's like drunk and he like throws a beer can at her because she wants him to be more like a parent. You know, everybody is like super flawed, and the worst thing to me about being an adult is watching it, and I started actually, there are two scenes in which I empathize with Vic Morrow.
Oh, yes.
Which is really depressing. But, you kind of see him, who's like the bad guy, and I'm always like, oh, when I started coaching Little League, I was like, well, that's not what I'm going to be. I know, that's a model of what I'm not supposed to do. And then, I'm like, well, God, he shouldn't have hit his kid. But, I mean, he did throw at the kid's head. it's like... something a little less severe, but yeah, that was bad news. Like he threw at the kid's head, like on purpose, you don't want anybody to do that. So it's funny. I mean, I think the characters in that movie are in some weird way, and not to sound like, you know, a total moron, but like are in a weird way more nuanced than most characters in like Academy Award winning movies.
No, I would agree completely on that. And I'm always reminded of a coach I had when I was about 11 or 12 after we, I don't know, had several errors out in the field. And he's standing in the dugout, as I recall, cigarette in hand, and looked at us right. And said, "Jesus, you guys, I bet on you and I'm losing. Come on." Like you're betting on a game of 11 and 12 year olds. This is fantastic.
That, you know, that. When I was like talking about the Pinewood Derby before, I recall vividly, if anything says 70s, it was this moment. Was I was watching, you know, the cars race. We're in the gym at my junior high school or middle school or whatever, and the guy who ran it was who ran Cub Scouts was watching over my shoulder, and he leaned forward, and his cigarette burned the back of my neck, and because he was smoking, of course, indoors, you know, while this was happening, and I bumped into him and he spilled scotch all over my shoulder. Like, no kidding. It was like every dad had a drink. Two-thirds of everybody except for my dad was smoking a cigarette. I mean, it was just, I always, even at the age of like 11, I was like, yeah, I'm gonna remember this. Something wrong is happening here.
Yeah, although at the time you weren't quite sure. You're like, I don't know, every dad is like this. I guess that's what dads do.
Completely. I was talking to, we had, this is now you're in trouble because I'm going to talk about spreading mulch. But my wife bought an excessive amount of mulch to spread, and it was sitting in our driveway. And like about 3 weeks ago. And I was very tempted to have one of my friend's kids or one of my kids' friends come over and pay them to spread the mulch. And it reminded me of, I had a friend growing up whose parents never let him have a sleepover unless there was yard work to be done. And he would say, literally, he'd be like, "Hey, Paul," he's like, "I think you ought to have like 5 or 6 friends sleep over tonight." And, you know, and you're so young, you don't even have any like institutional memory of like, yeah, God, he made us rake leaves for like 5 hours last time we slept over. So you're like, oh yeah, sure. Wow. What a treat. We get to sleep at Paul's house. And and that was the only time he ever could have kids over, was because there was a ton of yard work to be done.
You've inspired me.
You can't get away with that anymore. You can't use children like paid labor.
All right. Cause I was already salting that away for a couple of years down the road, because my son's only 7, but soon he and his friends will be old enough to do some yard work. So I may use it. I may try it anyway.
Yeah, I think you'll find that they're less inspired than people our age were.
Right. Again, didn't know any better.
General son.
No. We're talking with Josh Karp on Downtown. Well, you mentioned watching Smile in the Afternoons, and that triggered for me one of the supreme moments of 70s entertainment and education coming together in those ABC after school specials.
Oh yeah. So those were really sitting down and reading a list of the subjects and the scenarios and those things is like an afternoon worth of, I don't know if it's joy or horror or what it is, but it's unbelievable to read through them. There's one that I recall. I was doing, believe it or not, doing some research on these, and there was one where Red Buttons played a retired clown, like right there, right?
Wow.
who just missed being around children an enormous amount, and I can't even remember what he was doing, but I was like, it's like, oh my God, can you? I would love to have hear the pitch. Well, the old clown wants to be around children again.
Red Buttons, Scott Baio, a very special story.
I digress for 1 second. I was interviewing somebody about the Pink Lady and Jeff variety show the other day.
Oh, love it, love it.
And he said of he was talking about how they couldn't get any guests. And he said, I think Red Buttons was on 3 of our 6 episodes. He said, because he was about as difficult to get as a $25 sofa on Craigslist.
Carrie, do you have, Carrie may have information on this after school special with Red Buttons as a clown.
Yes, it was called Alexander, and one of his co-stars was Jodie Foster.
Oh, wow.
Of course.
Wow. Well, hey, speaking of Pink Lady and Jeff, you have talked to Jeff Altman?
I'm calling. He and I exchanged emails, and I'm calling him next week to set up our interview. But I've interviewed like all the writers about the brief, unhappy, very strange history of Pink Lady and Jeff.
Look forward to hearing more about that. Well, we'll have to get your full report the next time you're on, Josh. Always great to talk with you. Good luck with that mulch, and we'll catch up with you again soon.
Thank you so much, Rich. It's great talking to you, too.